Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, December 9th, 2012. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Theater Squared continues its seventh season with Period of Adjustment, with performances now through December 30th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studio. This play rediscovers Tennessee Williams' only comedy, a humorous and poignant exploration of love and the need for human warmth. Tickets and information available at theater2.org. or 443-5600.
Ahead on Ozarks, a reunion song, plus Big Cat Week on National Geographic Wild Channel.
But first, Arkansas Republicans have, and soon officially will have, a historic majority control over both the Arkansas House and Senate at the state capitol. That means they may anticipate a clearer path to enacting their top political action items. But Arkansas Democrats, counting on some semblance of bipartisan compromise, are also expecting to push legislation they deem critical. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports on priorities set by a sampling of state political advocacy groups on both sides of the aisle heading into the 2013 legislative session.
While a fresh array of Arkansas lawmakers orient and prepare for the 89th General Assembly, key activists are also getting ready. Rich Huddleston is executive director of Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families based in Little Rock. They work to ensure that children and their families have the resources and opportunities to lead healthy and productive lives. His top legislative action item is Medicaid expansion.
So that the state doesn't have to move forward with drastic cuts in the state's current Medicaid program, which could restrict access and hurt health care for some vulnerable populations out there.
He's concerned because Arkansas's Medicaid program faces a projected $298 million shortfall starting next summer because of a decrease in federal funding due to economic growth in this state. The Fed matches the state's Medicaid budget 3-1. So to fix it, Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe has proposed a formula adjustment, as well as cutting, among other things, coverage for certain low-income adults, the adult dental care program, and skilled nursing care for certain able-bodied elders. But if Arkansas chooses, or rather the newly seated Arkansas General Assembly votes to fully deploy the new Federal Affordable Health Care Act law, again, AACF Director Rich Huddleston.
Of course, one thing that's on the table right now is to extend health care coverage. It's a new option for the state to extend health care coverage for low-income adults up to 138% of the poverty line. There's new federal money to do that, and based on an analysis that DHS did, if we move forward with that extension to that population, it's actually going to save the state $372 million during the first 6 years of the Medicaid extension, and that, of course, would help our Medicaid budget crisis at the same time.
So under the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid could help an additional 250,000 Arkansans. But for this to happen, both the Arkansas House and Senate must issue a three-quarters majority vote. By the way, the new health care law requires all Americans to have some form of medical insurance starting in 2014 via Medicaid, their workplace, or individually through state-operated pools, referred to as health benefits exchanges. The second top legislative action item for the Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families is education. Rich Huddleston.
I'm expanding our investment in quality early childhood education, investing in quality after school and summer programs, school-based health programs, strategies that the research is pretty clear really works to help improve educational opportunities and success for low-income and disadvantaged students.
Another group with an intense interest in the legislative session is Arkansas Family Council, a conservative Christian education and research organization also based in Little Rock. Most recently, the Family Council campaigned successfully to block a statewide ballot initiative to legalize medical marijuana. Founder and executive director Jerry Cox said his first action item is ending abortion.
Arkansas needs to opt out of the abortion mandate in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Otherwise, we're going to be in violation of Amendment 68, which bans public funding of abortions. And I don't think the people of Arkansas want that.
So far, more than a dozen states have banned abortion coverage by their insurance exchange providers. Remaining states must offer a provider who doesn't cover abortion. Private insurers in pro-choice states will not be compelled to cover abortion. But with budget matters at the forefront of the next General Assembly and a lack of a Republican majority on both the House and Senate Public Health Committees, pro-life advocates may be hard-pressed to get their measures out front. The other item the Arkansas Family Council will continue to push is improving the state scholarship lottery.
Now, most people know that we opposed the lottery really from the beginning. But now that we have it, we think it ought to be run responsibly. And I think that having the lowest percentage for scholarships of any state in the nation is absolutely disgraceful. They shouldn't even be calling it a scholarship lottery when 80 cents of every lottery dollar goes somewhere other than the scholarships. So we'd like to see that amount raised to at least the national average of 31 cents on the dollar. If they'll do that, they'll have plenty of money to fund the existing scholarships and, in fact, offer more.
Our third group, the Arkansas Public Policy Panel, based in Little Rock, is a statewide organization dedicated to achieving social and economic justice by organizing citizen groups around the state. Organizer Peyton Rose lives in Damascus in Faulkner County, the epicenter of the state's lucrative shale gas industry.
Actually, we've narrowed it down to one, which is a landowner's bill of rights.
Peyton Rose says the bill would benefit both industry and property owners.
All of them, all landowners, should have adequate setbacks between drill sites and homes, drill sites and lakes and all streams. It's very important that gas developers use best management practices or a guide according to best management practices to protect land, air, water. Also, accurate information about their rights to landowners as surface or mineral right owners, an adequate notice, full disclosure of all gas development activities on property.
In addition, the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, which monitors surface water extraction and disposal by the gas industry, will ask legislators for additional money to increase the number of inspectors on its staff. And our last advocacy group is the Citizens First Congress, comprised of 57 member organizations across the state. A Northwest Arkansas caucus of the Citizens First Congress was recently convened in Fayetteville, hosted by the Omni Center for Peace, Justice, and Equality. Director Gladys Tiffany said they will be monitoring the rollout of Governor Mike Beebe's new Arkansas energy plan.
Things like biofuels and solar and conservation issues that would be upgrading school buildings and the buildings that state owns and making energy efficient and saving a lot of money for the state by doing that. I think there are some things that are going to be really, really important. So we're really looking forward to being able to support whatever the governor proposes and are looking forward to seeing exactly what he comes up with.
Implementing energy efficiencies and renewable energy policies, advocates say, will save consumers money, create jobs, and cultivate market certainty for clean energy investors in Arkansas. Gladys Tiffany said the Citizens First Congress will also advocate for creating an Arkansas Civil Rights Commission.
Arkansas is one of only three states that do not have a civil rights commission, and the advantage to that civil rights commission is that whenever any kind of civil rights issues come up, and if we had a civil rights commission in Arkansas, we would have this option to deal with a lot of these issues without having to engage the federal government.
Another member group of the Citizens First Congress is the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas, which advances educational opportunities for Hispanic women and their families. And Executive Director Margarita Solorzano says she has one objective for state legislators this session.
We would like for them not to get distracted trying to pass immigration reform issues that are of federal powers.
Rather, the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas supports enactment of a civil rights commission, as well as ratification of the ERA in Arkansas. It's been 40 years since the ERA was passed out of Congress. requires 38 states to ratify to become the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. 35 states have signed on so far, three short. Margarita Solorzano says if passed, the ERA would ensure that women have equal access to education, health care, jobs, and earnings.
And also to put Arkansas in a more competitive place in education and social issues.
While tax relief was mentioned by just one of our public policy advocates, Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe and certain Democratic legislators may work to reduce the state's grocery tax this session, while conservative legislators may seek to cut the state's income tax. State Republicans will have the advantage, given they have a majority on the state Senate Revenue and Taxation Committee. But just how conservative this new majority Republican legislature will act is anyone's guess. Just after the election, both Arkansas Republicans and Democrats pledged a cooperative and productive 2013 legislative session. And here's Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe addressing the Arkansas Chamber of Commerce a week after the general election.
It is incumbent on all of us to be able to reach common ground and to work together for the benefit of the people who are our bosses, because I have no doubt that Republicans and Democrats alike want to ensure that the people of Arkansas are properly represented and that whatever gridlock may exist elsewhere in the country, that will not exist with our own people.
The regular session of the 89th Arkansas General Assembly will convene Monday, January 14th, 2013. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Last Sunday in Week in Review, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis presented a series of stories involving education and money. Today, he again brings us education stories from the past week. But this time, the stories come with a twist of innovation.
In order to continually provide a viable education, schools must offer innovative programming to their students. One such story of innovative educational programming came this week from Rogers. Students at both high schools in Rogers will have a new elective course option next school year, as the district will be the first in Northwest Arkansas to offer a class in dance to its students. Phil Eichstadt is the district's executive director of secondary curriculum and instruction. He says that the class will take more of an academic approach to dance, including the history of dance and some dance instruction.
We're trying to expand our fine arts options a little bit. We've had a few, but we happen to have a teacher that is fully qualified to teach this and proposed this as a change actually last year, and we waited a year and she proposed it again and we put it in this year, and there's a lot of students that are excited about it, and it's a good addition to our fine arts curriculum.
While the course is a new offering in the district, the new class will not add to the school's budgetary needs.
There's a certain number of teachers assigned to every building based on the student population. And as long as the student population doesn't change, we don't really change the number of teachers. If we add a new class, students go into that class, but that's another class somewhere that they're not in. And it could result in another teacher having to shift to a different course, but it doesn't add any teachers.
Eichstadt says that district officials begin the process of revising the school's curricula in September. For next year, he says that many changes have been made to the course offerings in light of Common Core requirements. But innovative school offerings are taking place in another Benton County school district. On Monday, the district held a kickoff event for a new program to help strengthen students' bodies as well as their minds. Bentonville School's Superintendent Michael Poor says that the program will help infuse bicycling into all the district's schools.
All of our elementary, middle school, junior high, and high schools all got bikes. $150,000 grant, combination of multiple foundations, multiple companies all coming together, all contributing today into a really an amazing event where, you know, we're promoting healthy lifestyles of our kids and I think honoring this community too, because this is a community that loves its biking. So we will have kids actually getting to ride bikes and learn safety. We also hope that will help alleviate some of the traffic concerns that come with just people being on the roads and create a better alternative to get to our campuses each and every day.
To help make cycling a part of Bentonville's school curriculum, 540 new Trek bikes and helmets were given to the school, made possible through contributions from several area organizations and corporate sponsors. Mary Lay is the district's executive director of communications. I spoke with her a few weeks ago in preview of the event, and she said that she helped hatch the plan to incorporate cycling into the curriculum.
When you do a lot of research on Arkansas, American League of Bicyclists ranked us the 50th least friendly bike state, and that bothered me. And the rankings of obesity bother me. And then we have a wonderful school foundation here who had given a set of bikes already to Lincoln Junior High, and we've seen the kids ride them every day and just loving it and feeling great about it. And then my husband just retired from working for the International Olympics in the sport of triathlon, and he is now the outreach director for Bike Bentonville. So he's into the bikes, and with all the new trails here in Bentonville and the Razorback Greenway, it just makes sense to use the trails as an outside classroom.
Lay says that though other school districts in the area have made inroads to making cycling a larger part of students' everyday lives, the program at Bentonville Schools is unique.
I haven't found one district that has saturated it in every school and actually made it a real curriculum piece where there's different safety rules and things that are taught. And we had a historian from Rogers Historical Museum actually figured out the history of each trail. Like a slaughter pen used to be a pig slaughtering house, and Mobley Trail was from the apple orchards of the Mobley Farm. And so we're even going to teach history while they're on the bike.
Innovating in the classroom isn't limited to primary and secondary education, though. This week, we brought you a story about an innovation in education at one of the area's two-year colleges. Arkansas Tech University in Ozark is working to make sustainability and green concepts a part of the classroom. But instead of offering a sustainability major or other similar type of program, the college took a different tack. Bruce Sykes is the chief academic officer at the college.
We basically felt like it was our moral and ethical obligation as a university to develop a culture that environmental sustainability was taught throughout each program. So when you ask me which program has environmental concepts taught in it, I'm going to tell you that all of our programs are obligated to teach environmental concepts.
After deciding to make green concepts a regular part of courses at the college, Sykes says that campus officials had to come up with a way to identify what green concepts students are learning.
All the course syllabi will identify if there's a green concept that is taught to an industry standard, is taught in the course, then that course becomes green intensive. And if a student takes 12 credit hours of green intensive courses, then it's noted on their transcript that they are aware in their industry program, that they're aware of what the industry standards are as far as environmental sustainability.
Although 12 hours of classes fortified with sustainable concepts may seem like a substantial course load to achieve a green transcript, Sykes says that the extensive green training is crucial to having an impact on practices used in the industries in which the college's graduates will work.
What we want people to do is recognize that it's a part of your daily living and your daily job requirements, because we know our companies and our industries, it's a task for them to train people if people don't have some kind of appreciation for these type of concepts. So, you know, we basically embed it into our daily activity and our daily work.
Sykes says that green transcripts are unique to ATU Ozark, and that after he and campus officials presented the concept in Long Beach, California, other universities expressed interest in developing similar programs. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Big Cat Week kicks off this evening on National Geographic Wild Channel. Director and producer Tony Gerber's piece, Snow Leopard of Afghanistan, premieres tonight at 7. He says the film tells the story of an important, timely, and scary expedition to trap and collar snow leopards for study in Afghanistan. My immediate thoughts to that description were about the region being a war zone. Gerber corrected me.
No, timely because the study is a long time coming.
Okay.
There's very little known about these cats in this country, which is under siege. Scary because the country is under siege.
Okay.
So, but that much more critical.
Okay. So, why? I mean, you know, tell me a little bit about why this was such a long running. You know, why did it take so long to get to this point?
You know, I mean, Afghanistan has. You know, when you tell people that that Wildlife Conservation Society is working in Afghanistan, it almost sounds like a joke, or there's an assumption that they're a cover for some sort of spy network. You know,
When I told friends I was going to track snow leopards in Afghanistan, they were convinced that I was working for the NSA. That sounds like code for something, right?
Right.
So it seems completely absurd that there's any kind of precious endangered wildlife in Afghanistan, and B, that anyone would be crazy enough to work to conserve and protect it. We need to be protecting and conserving human lives, right? But the fact of the matter is that that the wildlife and in particular these endangered snow leopards are very, very critical to the heart of this particular region of Afghanistan, known as the Wakhan Corridor. They're a major source of pride. They have a potential to drive a burgeoning tourist industry, which would be a way for this region of the country to become self-sustaining. It's more or less a landlocked region, and in the winter, it's very inaccessible. So the snow leopard is a potential engine, an economic engine, and an engine for sustainability. So not just for that reason, but also because this is an incredibly beautiful and endangered cat, and there had never been any capture of a snow leopard prior to our expedition.
And this region that you talk of, is it the northeast?
It's the northeast. It's a tiny sliver of a panhandle that's part of what's known as the Hindu Kush, which is this legendary mountain range that Marco Polo traveled around, and Alexander the Great said it's higher than any eagle can fly. So it's this incredibly historic and remarkable location that's inhospitable, tough to get to, hard to live in. And you realize how durable and how well adapted these cats are to live up there.
So, if it's difficult for humans to live in this area, how do the snow leopard? How do they survive there?
Well, they were there before the people were, for one thing. So, you know, they wrote the book on how to survive up there. They have these very large paws, which are almost like, if you picture a monster truck with its big wheels and its small cab, you know, that's one of the most distinct physical qualities that it has, these giant paws, which enable them to grip and to move on very sketchy terrain. They also have these massive tails that are incredibly muscular and weighty that act like almost like a tightrope walker's pole, enabling them to balance again on very, very sketchy terrain, you know?
Well, I saw that tail in the film, and it looks, long and, beautiful.
Yes.
For
sure. Really stunning. They're known as ghost cats because they're so rarely observed. And their pelts have been prized for centuries, which also doesn't help them. You know, so you've got their habitat shrinking because the glaciers are melting as a result of climate change. You got the pasture lands are moving higher and higher up the mountain, so the shepherds are grazing their flocks higher and higher up. So the prey animals, the ibex and the marmots, are moving up the mountain, and so the terrain, the neighborhood for the snow leopard is getting hemmed in.
You mentioned that they're called, the ghost leopard.
The ghost cat.
They don't travel in packs. They travel alone. That kind of makes them harder to see.
That's correct. Yeah, and their camouflage is remarkable. I mean, your listeners, when they watch the film, they'll see at some point they'll see a wide shot of a cat on a rock face, and I defy anyone to say there's the cat. It's really incredible. Designers of military uniform could take a cue from this cat's camo. They're fiercely territorial. But they're habitual. They tend to run in loops, which is the one way that we were able to gain some intel, you could say, the Afghan rangers who'd been working this valley in advance of our expedition gathered incredible data from camera traps, which are heat and motion activated cameras with time date stamps, so we could begin to put together a picture of when the cats would go to particular regions of the valley and what their habits would be when they would return. So it was an incomplete picture, but it was something. So we had something to go on. So we had, at the outset, we had less than 20 days to capture a cat in a valley the size of the island of Manhattan. And by that first night, we had deployed only one snare, and that snare is the size of a Frisbee. So we're hoping that one cat in a valley the size of Manhattan would put his foot in a snare the size of a Frisbee. And you think of the odds of that, man. It's got to exceed 1,000,000 to 1.
And everybody in the film seemed very shocked, excited, even stressed out a little bit.
It was incredible, and it just caught everyone by surprise. You know, our trappers, Boone Smith and John Goodrich, had no expectation that it would be a snow leopard. You know, as they wearily get out of their tent in the middle of the night and put their headlamps on to make that long trudge up the mountain, you know, they expected to find a fox.
Right.
They expected to find that the wind had blown the magnet out of the transmitter.
Wow.
The last thing in the world they expected was a set of eyes staring right back at them.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and so, it was a snow leopard looking back at them, and it was
That's kind of
a process to dart and to tranquilize it.
Yep.
As well, and then, but eventually the snow leopard was tranquilized, and I must say that when they were walking up to that cat, I was scared. I really, you know, they kind of, you know, touched it a little bit, and I almost jumped.
Good, man. That means we did our job well, you know. I mean, the filmmaking in some ways is as important as the conservation work and the science, because we become the intermediary. We bring these stories to an audience. So, you know, they've got to be engaging.
Right. Yeah. What was it like being there to see animal that's so rarely seen?
I mean, the adrenaline is pumping, for one thing, and I think as John Goodrich says, and he's, you know, this is a career wildlife biologist and a man who's quite famous for capturing and collaring Siberian tigers. You know, he said that he always, whenever he's on one of these expeditions, he always reminds himself to take a moment to just remember where he is and what he's seen, and to take a moment to thank the cat for the privilege, you know, of allowing him to put his hands on it.
Right.
And to collar it in order to gain data and build a scientific study that will help preserve other cats, right? So thanking the cat then for that privilege, you know, and that's important. And it's, you know, it extends, I think, even to ordinary moments in our lives, that we have to remind ourselves, where we are, and what we're privileged to behold, whether it's something as extraordinary as a snow leopard in the Hindu Kush, or it's a child smiling.
Right. Right. No, I just recently read something that said, you know, if you're depressed, you're living in the past. If you're anxious, you're living in the future.
It's so true.
I really, I like that. I enjoyed that. So yeah, it really speaks to that. So, Tony, why is this film and the others that are taking part in Big Cat Week, why are they important?
Big Cat Week is an extension of National Geographic's Big Cat Initiative, which is a long-term program that seeks to halt the decline of the world's big cat populations. So it's important that that you guys watch, and that you're going to be in for an incredible treat.
All right, and this is the third Big Cat Week.
That's right.
Right, right.
And if I can mention one more thing, and you will pick and choose, but we do live tweet these broadcasts, so folks like the behind-the-scenes stories, the danger, the risk, how we got particular shots. I'll be doing a director's commentary live during the broadcast.
Okay.
For Snow Leopard of Afghanistan tonight, 8 p.m. East Coast.
And they can find you on Twitter where?
Twitter at Market Road Films.
At Market Road Films. Okay. All right.
Thanks
thank you so much, Best.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Tony Gerber is director and producer of Snow Leopard of Afghanistan. The film premieres tonight on National Geographic Wild Channel as part of Big Cat Week. Other films include Attack of Big Cats tomorrow evening and Tiger Dynasty on Tuesday. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
It is Sunday, December 9th, 2012. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And with us, Becca Martin-Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I feel like we're picking up a conversation from Friday.
Okay.
I wasn't
here Friday.
Yeah. You were here Friday. We were talking about the Nutcracker and opportunities to see it.
You mentioned there were this weekend in Fort Smith and Rogers.
Right. And next weekend, there's scenes from the Nutcracker, more or less the second act, going on in Springdale. It's part of the Holiday Nutcracker Show, and it's the debut of the Northwest Arkansas Arts Foundation. Mm-hmm. A woman named Kat Barlow, who owns a store that supplies dancers, saw a lot of kids that couldn't get what they needed. They couldn't get rehearsal space. They couldn't get classes. And she thought she would form a nonprofit to help them. And so they're in the process of getting their 501c3. And again, the Nutcracker, the Holiday Nutcracker Show is their debut to the public. Next year, they're going to start a capital campaign to try to build a practice facility.
Fantastic.
Really interesting. The dancers in this performance include Marisa Porter, who's dance mistress of Western Arkansas Ballet. She's dancing two roles this weekend for them.
Wow.
And then dancing the Snow Queen next weekend. Hannah Brown, who's from Northwest Arkansas and is a student at Brigham Young University. And Sally Ashcraft of Springdale, who's danced everywhere, including Edinburgh, will be in the show. The first half is a talent show that's dance students and other people from the area, and then the parts of the Nutcracker as the second act.
Does the second act include March of the Wooden Soldiers?
I don't think so. Okay. But it does include all of the, like, the Arabian and the...
Right.
I have a question about the first act. Is it, I mean, is it a holiday-related talent show at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I wasn't, yeah. Okay.
I think Brick Fields is performing.
No. Oh.
And I'm not entirely sure who else, but it should be fun. It's $15 to $20, 7 o'clock on the 15th and 2 o'clock on the 16th at the Pat Walker Theater at Springdale High School.
Okay.
And this afternoon, you can see Ballet West Side's The Nutcracker at 2 o'clock at Rogers High School, or Western Arkansas Ballet's The Nutcracker at 2:30 at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith.
So plenty of opportunities. Can't see The Nutcracker this time. You're just too busy.
Exactly. There's also a couple of other things this afternoon, including the Ozark Bronze Handbell Ensemble performing at 3 o'clock at the Fayetteville Public Library. There's a Riders on the Orphan Train program. Allison Moore and Phil Lancaster.
At Bella Vista Public Library.
Exactly, at 3 o'clock.
And on December 11th at 7 p.m., they'll be at the Paris Public Library in Logan County.
Excellent.
Yes.
He knows so much.
He does. Too much sometimes.
That's a whole different conversation. And The Messiah is being done at 6:30 today at Bella Vista Lutheran Church.
All right.
All right.
Plenty.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, December 9th, 2012. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And joining us now is Katie Henriksen, host of Sunday Symphony.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
What do we have? What do we have on this evening?
Three symphonic works. We've got something from a Swedish composer, Hugo Alfvén. His dates are 1872 to 1960. We have Brahms Symphony No. 2. Actually, both those symphonies, weirdly enough, I didn't even notice, they were symphonies, they're second symphonies, and they're both D major. And then a Benjamin Britten piece. It's actually the first symphonic work he composed at age 26 in 1940. That's his Symphonia de Requiem.
So he's a little bit younger.
Yeah, he's a 20th century composer. So yeah.
And as you were walking to the studio, you were mentioning something about the Britten Symphony. He was commissioned to write it.
Yeah, there's a really fascinating history behind that work, and you know, off the top of my head, I won't be able to recall the exact details, but he was 26. He had not come up as a famous composer yet, but the Japanese Empire at the time was looking for composers to compose works on the event of the 2600th anniversary of the establishment of the Japanese Empire, and they approached the British government, who then approached Britain to compose a work. So they commissioned, in essence, a work from Britain, Benjamin Britten, and he decided he would write something, but he made it a requiem, which offended the Japanese. And it was also it took names from a Roman mass, Roman Catholic mass. So for many reasons, the the Japanese decided not to use the work, and Britain himself is an avowed pacifist, so he had obvious reasons for wanting to make it a requiem. He was making statements, even if he tried to like say that it wasn't a statement of anything, because it was shortly before all the things happened in World War II with the bombing of Pearl Harbor and everything else that ensued in World War II. So, but that all he composed that all before that happened.
And so also Brahms.
Brahms Symphony No. 2. And the interesting thing about this is a recording Cele Bedache. He's a Romanian conductor, famous conductor, who died in 1996. Now, he has interesting philosophy on recordings. He actually says that recordings cannot, you cannot obtain a transcendental experience outside the concert hall. And so he actually really, during his lifetime, he didn't really want any recordings issued when he was conducting anything. But posthumously, his family, his widow, and his son have decided to release some of the recordings. But he has a very fascinating philosophy on, I mean.
So he argued that the experience you could have in the live concert hall could not be replicated,
right?
Or at least could not be transcendent on record,
right?
Which makes sense.
It does make sense, but not everything has to be transcendent. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, yeah. So the liner notes in this recording actually go into detail about all that and why they decided that they were going to issue these recordings. And I mean, for obvious reasons, people couldn't get to that concert hall. They couldn't hear. Some people will never be able to get to a concert hall and hear something. And with a recording, we can bring it to you in your house. You know.
Yeah.
So
who's to say that you're not going to have a wonderful experience listening to it in your house?
Yes.
Or in your car.
It's a different experience.
Exactly.
To be sure.
Exactly.
So,
which you can do tonight.
That's right. At 7.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks, guys.
Though it doesn't really feel like it, it's wintertime. Bears hibernate. Humans wear layers. What do bugs do? In particular, bees. I decided to find out.
Don't know. Here comes another one. Let's see.
That's Dr. Don Steinkraus, an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. He is standing in front of a row of beehives at the off-campus research farm. On this sunny but windy day, he's surprised to see bees flying in and out of the hive.
This is actually really quite cool for it. I mean, it's windy. That one had pollen on its legs, though, and they're exceptionally good at finding a few flowers, even in like wintertime if they get a warm day. Dandelions sometimes bloom in like sunny little warmer pockets.
Americans typically keep European bees, bees from Italy, Germany, and Hungary. Bees that are accustomed to this environment. Arkansas winters aren't really very harsh, especially this one. If there's a warm day, bees will come out in search of whatever pollen they can find.
They also do a thing called cleansing flights. Bees typically don't defecate in their hive. So on a warm day, they come out and they'll defecate outside of the hive. So they sort of hold it until they are able to get out on a warm day.
They can easily hold it for weeks on end. Further north, in places like Minnesota or Canada, where the winters are much colder, bees aren't able to get out of the hives as often or for very long. If it gets below 50 degrees, the bees want to cluster inside of the colony or beehive.
They don't hibernate, so they have this cluster. The colder it gets, the tighter the cluster of bees. Just like if you were really, really cold in your some unheated tent and you had other buddies there, if you got really cold, you might cluster together to warm each other up. So that's what they do. They warm up by hanging out in this ball, and they eat honey all winter long.
Honey is the fuel which runs the bee colony. A cold-blooded insect, bees use the honey to generate heat in their wing muscles. Vibrating them allows them to produce a small amount of heat per bee.
But when you add that up with, like, say, 30,000 bees in a cluster, that generates enough heat to keep the cluster warm, even if it's, like, minus 20 degrees outside.
30,000 bees fit into a hive that's about 3 feet tall, and not even that wide. It's enough to keep the internal temperature of the cluster at 60 to 90 degrees, depending on the outside temp.
And the bees on the outside of the cluster get cold, and they gradually move into the interior of the cluster, and other bees in the interior move to the outside. So they all keep somewhat warm all winter. So if you could stick a thermometer into the cluster of bees, it might be like 80 degrees even in the center of it.
There's a sort of safety in numbers thing going on here. If the cluster gets too small, the entire thing could die in a cold spell. To keep those numbers up, the bee colony overall must be healthy, especially the bees going into the winter generation. A summertime bee's lifespan is 40 to 50 days. A wintertime bee lives about 4 months.
So these bees are slightly different physiologically than the ones in the summer. But if the generation being produced in August and September, the new adult bees being produced then, is of poor quality, if they're diseased or if they've been fed on by mites too much or something, they may not be very healthy and they die early, and then the colony dwindles and you lose your colony.
Bees die every day, just like humans do.
I read the obituaries every day in the newspaper, and every day, you know, 5 or 10 people die in northwest Arkansas, and probably 5 or 10 more are born. And in the bee colony, though, in the wintertime, the queen's not active laying eggs very much, generally not until like January comes around. She'll start laying again. So they're having to depend upon overwintering from the adult bees in that group.
A problem right now is the weather. It's warm and the bees are active, getting out of the hive. But there aren't any floral sources out there. They're wasting energy looking for pollen that just isn't there. For beekeepers, it's important to make sure they have honey in the hive, or pollen pads, even sugar or corn syrup water, anything they can sustain themselves on. For non-beekeepers, if you see them around your hummingbird feeder, well, just let them be. Entire colonies can be lost. It used to be just 10% or so.
In the last decade or something, it's been closer, maybe 25-30% lost. And if you're a commercial beekeeper, that's a big loss. And that's why there's a lot of research going on right now to how can we minimize these losses. And they're due to many different factors. Lots of different little parasites which feed on the bees, and declines in pollen and nectar quality, and, you know, all kinds of things.
There are a number of things you can do to prepare bees for winter. As simple as removing excess honey, but making sure there's still enough. A 30,000 bee colony needs 20 to 30 pounds for a typical winter here. Beehives also need protection from predators.
Sometimes people put mouse guards across the bottom so mice won't get into the hive and damage it, which they will sometimes. They'll come in when the bees are in their cluster and they can eat a few of the bees, and they can eat some honey and pollen and chew on the wax and cause a mess. They make the little nests in there. So usually people put a bee guard on.
They're cold and looking for food too.
Yes, that's right.
In this climate, we almost always have one day a week where the bees can fly, and keepers are able to keep a ventilation board on bottom all year long.
So the varroa mites and things will fall out and not get back on the bees, and also provide some ventilation. So you'd think that, you know, if you have an open bottom and it's really cold, it'd be really harmful for the bees, but they actually generally can do all right.
Prior to this interview, Stein Krause wasn't able to promise that we could look inside a hive. It's bad to mess with them too much, and you definitely don't want to let in the cold air. But as we've already mentioned, it's warm enough.
So let's open this hive and take a look, okay? And you don't have your suit zipped up, I have to tell you. So they would fly right up inside of your hood.
Okay, well, please and help. This is my first experience.
Yeah, you don't want them to fly.
This is my first experience.
You don't want them flying up in
no,
your hood.
No, I definitely don't want them in my hood.
No, normally.
My hands too.
Normally when we open a beehive in the summertime or spring, we smoke the bees. And I'm not going to do that today. I'm just going to open up. We have our bee suits on. We should be protected pretty well. So I'm going to open up. We'll just look and see what they're doing, okay? So now, if you look here, here are some bees. Now, they're going to probably get really grumpy because they don't want to be opened up. And you can see they're still alive and active in here because today is a fairly warm day. And so you can... They're just doing their thing. They're eating a little honey, and a few of them are going out foraging. They're probably taking care of maybe a little bit of brood in there. I'm not certain about that. And if we open it up more, we'd see more and more bees. And so, any questions about that?
I don't know. I just got kind of scared all of a sudden.
Yeah, me too. Because we didn't smoke them. See, one's trying to sting me right now.
Dr. Don Stein Krause is an entomologist with the University of Arkansas. I visited the hives on the research farm earlier this week. For more information on raising your own bees, contact the U of A Agricultural Extension Service.
When it comes to popular culture, bees have definitely not been well represented. Swarms of killer bees attacked in movies and television episodes in the 1970s and 80s. It was a giant bee that threatened our heroes in the 1961 bee movie, Mysterious Island. In music, bees get slightly better treatment, usually associated with love. Here is our Sunday morning montage this week, all associated in some way with bees.
But I kind of got my hands full with these babies.
He's got bees! Oh, bees! Oh, get it!
They don't allow you to have bees in here.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees, the moon up above, and a thing called love.
I'm a little black rain cloud, of course.
Silly old bear.
Now, would you aim me at the bees, please?
I'm going out.
Out? Out where?
Outside the hive.
So tell me, Sam, what you want to do? When no one in love with you, third time you turn around.
Eyewitnesses say that the bees are yellow and black.
Do as I say, senor, you white guys!
Much the way Eli Wallach did in the movie The Magnificent Seven. The bees are also overweight.
They're turn their radio off!
And danger.
Wait a minute. You must be the...
That's right, gringo.
The killer bees!
Yeah, I've got it right here in front of me.
The African bees.
Call you back.
The African bees that killed Paul's mother and father are back. Get everyone inside and everything locked up.
Come on. You call the park, you call the ball field. I'm calling the school.
Well, I'm a king bee. Buzzing around your hive. Well, I'm a king bee. Buzzing around your hive. Well, I can make honey, baby. Let me.
If you want to see the lineup of our bee-related material, you can go to OzarksAtLarge.com.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
And earlier this month, the For the Moment reunited Still on the Hill, that's Phil Lancaster, John Johnston, Kelly Mulholland, and Donna Stierna, came to the Firm and Garner Performance Studio. They did that because they're having, for the first time in about a decade, a concert together as a four-piece. It'll be the 14th in Star Theater at Walton Arts Center.
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. Thank you. We ran the full or much of the interview earlier this week on the Daily program. They performed two songs while they were inside the Firm and Garner studio. This week we didn't have enough time to put both on, so now here is one. This is the four-piece, Still on the Hill, singing Downtown.
One, two, three, four. Yes, I could stay at home, I could read a book or two, I could try to get a little bit better at some of the bad things that I do, but the night is young, so I'm out for a little while, gonna put on my hat, coat and pants, my boots and smile, won't go downtown, tonight, all around the town, gonna check out all those sights, we'll be back in the morning, feeling bad or good, gonna do what I want, but I don't do what I should. Well now, if you've ever checked it out, you know just what I mean. There's always a few surprises in that same old scene. And you might meet some fella who can really blow the horn, make you glad for a change. You done got bored, going downtown.
Downtown.
Tonight, all around the town. Gonna check out all those sights. We'll be back in the morning, feeling bad or good. Gonna do what I want, but I don't do what I should. woman, I might get lucky and run into my friend Jane. Walk to her apartment in the shiny city rain. Gonna put on a little record. I'm gonna be so long and tall. I'm gonna be the wallpaper. Jane gonna be the wall. Downtown. Tonight, all around the town. Don't check out all those sights. We'll be back in the morning, feeling battle good. Gonna do what I want, but I don't do what I should. Run into my friend Jane and walk to her apartment in that shiny city rain. I wanna put on a little record, wanna be so long and tall. I wanna be the wallpaper, Jane gonna be the wall. Downtown,
downtown
tonight, all around the town. Check out all the sights. We'll be back in the morning, feeling battle good. Gonna do what I want, but I don't do what I should. Have you ever noticed all the things just before the dawn? Well, the morning is still sleeping and the night is not yet gone. And you walk into some little joint with the one you love, with the moon and the stars and the bells and the birds all ringing up above. Downtown,
downtown
tonight, all around the town. Well, but you got all those sights. We'll be back in the morning, feeling battle good. Gonna do what I want, but I don't do what I should.
That was Still in the Hill, the reunited four-piece Still in the Hill. Phil Lancaster, John Johnson, Kelly Mulholland, Donna Stierna. They're playing a one time concert, the 14th in Star Theater at Walton Arts Center at 8 o'clock.
Did I see, and something I read there, Crow Johnson is
yes.
going to be a special
yes,
guest?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. Crow Johnson will be a special guest. Crow, when they were a four-piece, was their manager.
Oh, okay.
So this is a real mm-hmm. big reunion, and I think a lot of people who've been in Northwest Arkansas for some time are going to be very excited about this. It's at Walton Arts Center. It's also kind of a Mike Shirky production, so you've got Mike and Crow and the reunited Still in the Hill. Very much fun on the 14th.
It'll be a good evening.
Yes, it will.
Good deal.
I should tell you that this is KUAF, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Johnson.
Johnson. I know where that is.
Yeah. I shouldn't say everybody.
North.
Yes. Yes. Also want to say that I went to Billy Elliot this week on Thursday night, and it was a fantastic show. Yeah, I think there are two more. This afternoon,
I think
tonight,
so, at 2:30 and 7?
Something like that.
Maybe. I don't know. Go to waltonartcenter.org yeah.
Right.
For
And I'm not a big musicals person.
Right.
But this one blew me away.
It is. It's a good story, too.
It is. It's a fantastic story about labor relations, about familial relations, about identity for community.
Right.
And the set is stunning. It's stunning.
All right.
Okay.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Happy Sunday, I guess.
Thank you very much.